Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Kirk Gray.
And this is Fred Schenkelberg. Hey, Kirk, I understand your neck of the woods is burning these days.
Yeah, Colorado's been on fire. And in fact, we can see it from Boulder, the very sad fire occurring at Left Hand Canyon and up around Lyons. We certainly hope everybody's safe up there and gets evacuated in time. And boy, do we need rain.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's, or snow or anything.
Or anything. Yeah. Well, you might get it all in one day is the way you guys
do stuff. That's the problem. After it burns the hills, there's not a lot of stuff holding the ground together. And that becomes a problem, too.
Yeah.
With mudslides and all kinds of things.
Well, so you're talking to but it's not just the fires, you know, in Colorado and the West, which are right now in California. I'm sure there's still fires going, but our sky is clear, which has been nice given the last 6 weeks. But there's also hurricanes rolling through the Gulf states. There's, you know, it's just one day after another this year.
Right.
But, you know, one of the things, and this is a question I got the other day, is that, you know, in a kind of an abrupt transition to a topic here, but it was a question. I got a phone call, actually. This guy said, Hey, are you available to help us do an FMEA and a prediction? And I was like, I hate doing predictions. It's not really useful. And
it's misleading.
Yeah. So we got on the phone and my thought process was, because of the way the email phrased stuff, it was like, do you just want these pieces of paper to give to somebody else, maybe like as a condition of sale, or do you actually want to use it to improve your product? And then in that case, I'd talk you out of doing a prediction because it's very rare that it's actually going to do anything useful for you.
Right.
And I was surprised. He said, you know, I understand what you're saying completely. I appreciate your honesty on this and stuff, but we're moving to a new market and that new market requires us to have an FMEA and a prediction under these certain formats, using a particular software package and in a certain format, and all these bells and whistles. And I'm like, okay, so you're not going to use this to improve your product? Oh, hell no. He's like, no. We've had this product out for years. It's working great. We've refined it, you know, ad nauseum. We're putting it into a new market, but it's the same exact conditions. You know, it's nothing. Nothing's really changing. There's not any new risk or anything, but they want it just because they got to check it off their box.
Right. And it's typical of a military or a government contractor that this continues to perpetuate in that particular industry more than any others I've ever seen, because most engineers that have done these and have followed the product later or tried to compare, or as you said, that this company had already had that product in manufacturing and use, and it had very few failure modes. So they're not adding any value by, you know, doing a parts count or even you know, temperature, time, fit rate thing that has nothing to do with the real causes of failures, in my opinion, in the field. And if they've already got the field data to show that part's okay or has very few failures in their previous, you know, years of usage, that should be sufficient.
Yeah, drive on. Use the real data. You know, why not?
What could be better than showing, you know, and I even show maybe a few of where there was a failure, because most products, you know, have some failure. And it could be because of misuse, or it could be because of an outside event that caused it to fail. And they could show that too.
Yeah, they could actually show, and here's what we did about it, or here's stuff we learned early on and we fixed.
ESD protection or something like that. So
but it's not just this scenario though, Kirk. It's, and you've seen it in other places. Now, by the way, the very first time I did a prediction, way back, it was it was a division at HP that made tape backup drives. This is way back. And and it was a customer called Dell. You know those guys. and the procurement guy said, oh, we need a parts comp prediction. Yeah. And I was floored. Yep. If I'd have known you at the time, I would have called you up and yelled at you.
Oh, I was yelling internally. Don't worry.
Okay. That's what I've learned since.
I held meetings regularly, you know, to talk about strategies and how they need to test and compare the limits between samples, you know, operational limits.
Learn
push
something.
It to the limit. Yeah. See what capability and margins you have, and then determine whether you can do anything to make them better or you even need to. Yeah. So these things stick around because everybody's so, I mean, it gives them some kind of warmth of, you know, feeling they did something for reliability. And it's totally false.
Well,
it has nothing to do.
Well, I know. But here's another scenario, though. Rather than, you know, doing a parts count, whatever. I don't want to go into that because we've beat that one a lot. But another scenario that I think is just as pernicious, there's my word for the day, just as is common and detrimental to getting something useful done. And I'm sure you've seen it, is a new program comes up and they says, we're going to make a computer that's going to change like 20% of this product. We're going to cost reduce it. We're going to do this or do that.
Right.
And we'll use the reliability plan from the last product. Or the one before that, you know, it's similar enough that we'll just do all that same stuff again.
Yeah.
But they change like a material set, or they change a mechanical system of it, or they change pieces of it. But the old tests don't explore that stuff. And then they learn it the hard way when they get to you at the halt test or the customers get it. But how many times have you seen somebody set up their plan where they just take the old one and say, well, it worked last time. Let's use it again.
It's pretty standard. I mean, people get used to doing the same thing over and over again, and they'd kind of are, you know, and if the plan were to take it to its limits,
then you would learn something, right?
Operational limits, right. And you know,
but in that scenario, Kirk, only if you sit back again and think through what stresses should we apply, right? Now, as we're getting to the super high frequencies on some of our devices.
Right.
And if you don't ever explore the effect of the frequencies on your circuits, then you could still be doing a test from 10 years ago when we were in the megahertz range, and now we're in ultraviolet frequencies, it seems like, millimeters length, you know?
Yeah, microwave range.
We're way
higher
up there. But it has a different,
right?
Yeah, it has a different fundamental behavior with the material. So if you don't explore the effects of frequencies because you never did before, you're going to learn the hard way. And so I think that part then leads to an organization that just says, all right, well, I check off the temperature humidity test, I check off the vibration test, and it's just a checklist again, and it doesn't really help anything.
No.
What other way
can we do this? You just mentioned the frequency issue, and that's one area in digital electronics has always been increasing. You know, the number of process nodes, the higher frequencies, and materials act differently in response to frequency, and you know, second and third order effects that weren't a big deal at lower frequencies now become a big deal when you're in a very, very, very high speeds and, you know, pushing the boundaries of what you can do with electrons. And I think optics are probably the next level that they're going to be working on, in quantum computing and all the other things. But that's where now I believe temperature is becoming much more important, and being able to skew the timings of these very high speed circuitries and systems by using thermal stress, both cold, which speeds up the signals, and hot, which slows down the signals, allows you to kind of push the margins on those. And that's becoming one of the biggest reliability, I guess, the worries or challenges is when a problem is intermittent.
No. And well, just blame that on software. Just blame that on software.
Well, you know, right. And there's, as I've written before in book and other places, I've said that, you know, the one area that's is this huge void in the study of engineering reliability and software and hardware. And that is the effects of hardware variations, modifications, change in solders, change in manufacturing techniques or shapes or geometries, how that affects, because it does have an effect on signal transmission throughout the board. Mm-hmm. And, you know, capacitance between the layers in the metals, the inductance, all those are very frequency dependent. And as you get up in the very high speeds, that can be a new challenge. And there was a company in New Zealand that did find that thermal energy found some timing problems. In fact, a significant percentage of their timing problems were found by going to the boundaries and operational limits, which really was, changing the speed of the signals mm-hmm. through thermal stress. And that's a simple, that's so simple. Mm-hmm. The other one is voltage. Obviously, voltage, frequency, thermal are key parameters that you would use to make a multidimensional plot of different samples and how they handle it and different functions. And it's getting the whole system to play together, not just checking one particular function, one processor, one node. It's having the whole thing run like you're just overstressing with applications till you really are maxed 100% of the CPU's capacity, and you're really running it hard. Yeah. That may be a special case.
You brought up one of the ideas that I've seen turn into a checklist thing, and I'm going to blame our colleagues across the aisle, the quality engineers, right? And you've heard of SMART goals, right? It's specific, yes. Measurable, whatever. I don't remember accurate. I don't remember what they all are. But we work with a team and they create, here's the functional characteristics or specifications. It's going to be 3 pounds and it's going to be gray. And then they argue for 6 weeks about what color gray and so on. And I'm poking fun at them a little bit here, but I've seen it where they only want specifications that they can measure because they have a process to say at the end of the day, did you achieve this? And so we have to be able to measure it. And then they look at the reliability stuff and we say, well, it needs to be reliable and we needs to be this reliable at this time frame and everything else. And I've had more than one of these quality folks look at me and go, well, we don't know how to measure that. So that's not a specification. And I'm like, what? Or it just becomes a checklist item of, all right, we hit this functionality, like once on one prototype. And so they check it off. And they're like, well, wait a second. If we put this thing outside where it's going to be used, that color gray is going to turn into this aquamarine, fungus looking thing. And he says, well, don't. And the quality guys are like, well, our criteria is that does it come out of manufacturing with the right color? He says, what about the customer? do they want that ugly color or do they want the beautiful gray that you got? Whatever.
Yeah.
It's just the idea that we're going to create a checklist of the functionality of the stuff we can measure and we're going to check them off. And some, to be fair, some consider, well, what is the effect of, earwax or sweat or UV light and over time.
Yeah.
And they start, crossing over and saying, hey, what about this reliability stuff? But it's been more the exception than the rule in my experience.
Well, it kind of gets back to where is an acceptable failure rate and planning for a known failure rate. Mm-hmm. That's what, when I have a problem with it, that we can control how reliable, inherently know from the beginning or can control from the beginning how reliable this product is going to be because of the dynamics of manufacturing, the design, and all these particular as you said, you know, Armin pointed out, somebody might have a different application for the same part or same subsystem that they don't ask you for approval. They just assume that mm-hmm. it'll go into that. But there's so many factors that I've never been able to see how, other than using the inherent field data that you have from your past similar products, that we have that kind of control of rates of failure. Because ideally, you know, up to a certain point, yes, I think we talked about it last time, you know, how much protection to put around a smartphone.
Mm-hmm.
But you really don't know what. You could guess without this, you know, protection of shock protection around the outside, how many times the phone might be dropped mm-hmm. and it would take, or what distance it would take to break it. But mm-hmm. you don't really know how the public, how careful it will be with it, or, you know,
unless they have daughters like ours.
Yeah, unless they have daughters. And I, you know, like I show you, my daughter's phone got smashed. It's an iPhone. It's got a cracked screen around the touch button where the fingerprint, where it reads your fingerprint, is all cracked and split apart. And yet the phone still functions.
Yeah.
She says it works.
Yeah.
She hadn't had a problem with it. So I said, well, you've got a lot of places where moisture can intrude now. And, you know, it's just really a matter of time, but it may be a long time.
Yeah,
you know, she
yeah.
still has a case around it. So even that kind of condition, even with it being damaged, you don't know that it's going to fail. And so I just really have a hard time with trying to quantify before the product or that effort, as opposed to really focusing all your effort, everything you do, on finding the limits, as many samples as you can. If you have more than 3 or 4 or 5, you can compare the limits of operation. It doesn't always, especially in digital electronics, you don't break it by generally. And if you do, you better very, very carefully investigate that part.
Yeah, but if the function doesn't quite perform, or there's a timing issue, those are more common.
You can get variable you can get variable data, like a bit rate error of, say, optical transceiver, or laser transceiver, or, you know, VCSEL thing that I worked on one time. You know, as you're going up in temperature, your bit error rate will start to climb.
And you could say what's susceptible or not for these retransmissions.
And right, but you compare that, you know, because it's such a small little, you know, 3-inch little module, you could take a whole bunch of them and compare that curve per temperature increase, how that drops off. And if you find one that's, you know, significantly lower than the others, and that's kind of the one to investigate or look at in more careful detail.
Why is that useful?
What's different?
Yeah.
Exactly. And then you might find it useful information, or you might find that, hey, it just didn't have the right soldering, you know, mm-hmm. some of the connections were poorly.
Well, and we've talked about this many times, is that you need to go learn stuff. And I think that's the problem with the checklist type of approach.
Absolutely.
Whether it's you using a set of standards, or you're just doing something because it's a requirement for the sale, or in those cases, you're kind of stuck. If you want to sell it, like I was, if we wanted to sell this stuff to Dell, I had to do a prediction and learn how to do it. I remember I was an hour into it, and I walked down to my boss and I said, "This is really useless. Why are we doing this thing?" And he says, "Well, so they can sell the product." You know, he checks it off the box.
I'm sure you've seen in your inbox, you know, places in India or software, you know, people over there that'll do it for, you know, you send us your bomb or your whatever.
Send the bomb, and 2 hours later we'll send you.
Yeah, 2 hours later we'll send you a prediction on, you know, in MTBF, your favorite term.
Yeah.
And
but it's,
you know,
it's the issue is that we get trapped into these checklist types of approaches. Sometimes it's just, we think it's a time-saving thing, so we pick the old program, or it's just the standard, and we got to meet these standards. That's all we'll do. It's all the time we got, and we check them off, or there's a set of functions or specifications. Let's just make sure those work without. And the hard part here, Kirk, what I think is the biggest issue with this type of checklist thing is that we stop thinking. We stop thinking about, what are we trying to learn here? What are we trying to accomplish? What's the objective here?
Yeah.
And you've illustrated a number of different ways that we can go about doing something better But the hard part, Kirk, is that there's not a checkbox at the top of the thing that says, put your brain back in your head and start and turn it on.
And you'd really like to go, you know, question it all the way up to where the originator is, or somebody who's, you know, perpetuating this and asking for it and saying, you know, and even, you know, even the military has come against, you know, using cookbook approaches like 217 and all of its progeny. And there's a great, you know, article, and I can catch it on my website, Reliability Prediction, A Continued Reliance on a Misleading Approach, written by two from the U.S. Army and one from CALS. And it just points out exactly why this is a misleading approach and costly and needs to stop. But they even write it, and it comes out, and it just doesn't stop because there's too much vested interest in the current culture and spares and cost of spares. And as I said before,
it's a large
60% of one guy's came up to me directly involved in the program, said 60% of my profits of this whole program come from spares and service.
Yeah, why would I want to make it better?
A little conflict of interest. Yeah, there's a definite conflict of interest. So those are kind of the reasons that some of this stuff still continues to persist, even though, as you pointed out, we just use it to paper our walls or send it in. Somebody sticks it in a filing cabinet and doesn't mean anything. It's, of course,
but we still spend $10,000 doing it, and it just kind of perpetuates. And so, so the issue
I'll
is here.
I'll do it for $1,000.
Yeah. Well, no, you won't. You won't do it.
No, I won't. I won't do it for anything. Yeah. Right. Not anymore.
So the point is that part of what we do in the reliability world, and if we actually want to create a reliable product, was try to recognize when you're falling back on the old checklist approach.
Right.
And is that a time to step back and say, all right, is this actually going to add value? Is this actually going to be useful? Is this actually going to mean anything? Can I do something with the results? And if the answers are no, well, I suggest, and I think Kirk, you would agree, is, well, don't do that. You know, go do something useful.
Right. Somebody, though, is asking for it up the chain. And, you know, to keep your job, you might have to do it. But that and it's, you know, really the lesser path of least resistance is to go ahead, you know, because you can whip out a parts count pretty fast with the software nowadays, I think. Put in it's, you know, meaningless, as opposed to going up the chain and finding part
Where's
of management
coming
or procurement.
From,
Yeah, and saying, what do you guys expect from this? Why are you doing this? And, you know, bringing up the articles like I just mentioned and saying, this is a misleading approach.
The podcast.
Or listening to our podcast, right, and hearing people constantly, not just you and me, but you and others and the team pointed out too. So, you know, that's the way it's going to be,
I guess. Yeah. So anyway, if you listening to this and hopefully we've painted a couple of scenarios where you might be in a checklist kind of mode here. So, you know, hopefully that, you know, wakes you up a little bit, says, oh, wait a sec, what are we really trying to do here? So start asking some questions and, you know, take a stand if it's the right thing for you to do. But I'd love to hear about how the stories, especially the ones that where somebody recognized that this is an issue and solved it. And, you know, kind of a before and after story, it would be wonderful to hear. But if you've got any questions, if you think you're may or may not be in a checklist type approach to reliability, let us know. We'd love to hear from you, and we can bring it up on another episode. We're at ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR, and you can find a form there to get in touch with us. Excuse me. And Kirk and I and the other hosts are available on LinkedIn and on our About pages on Ascendo. So there's plenty of ways you can get in touch with us. And we do sincerely look forward to hearing from you.
Yeah, I'd love to hear from somebody that's convinced management not to use a parts count. If anybody has those stories, we'd love to hear them.
Oh, definitely. They'd make our day. Yeah. All right, Kirk. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay, Fred. Talk to you later.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.